The Six Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM Portland.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, good morning, Northwest and Portland, Oregon. A little cloudy day today. And in studio today with me, you're listening to Investing Simplified. If you have a question, you can call us also at 800-990-0750. That's 1-800-990-0750. And any callers today that call in and ask a question will get a free copy of Harry Dent's book called The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019. And in the studio today with me is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Morning, Carl. And Kevin Stege, we're happy to have Kevin back from the taxes with Baker Colson CPA firm.
That's right. Good morning.
Yep. And Kevin, have you recuperated?
No.
Okay. Well, I didn't think so. But we're glad to see you.
Good to be here.
And, you know, this morning we're going to have Rodney Johnson on the air. And a month ago, Carl and I had the distinct pleasure of talking to Harry Dent for about 40 minutes. And it was one of the better shows we've ever had, I think.
Well, actually, Harry had the distinct pleasure of talking to us for 40 minutes.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, listen, with no further ado, we're going to have Rodney Johnson, who's co-editor with Harry S. Dent, economist, on the free newsletter Survive and Prosper. And I always like to say that Rodney Johnson, the dynamic duo, him and Harry Dent, Rodney is the elegant one. He is the excellent speaker. So, Rodney, are you there?
Yes, I am, Chuck. How are you this morning?
I am great. Did you like that introduction?
I did, but I noticed that when you were talking about your show with Harry a month ago, you said it was one of the better shows you've ever had, and I know that you just forgot to put at the end of that sentence, except for all the shows we have with Rodney Johnson, which are much better.
Well, I just said that to set you up today, because today you're going to knock it out of the park.
There you go.
Right?
Absolutely.
And you know what? You're not very – well, I don't know how far you are from Miami, but I had the distinct unpleasure last night of watching the Seattle Mariners play Miami, and Miami won the game in the bottom of the ninth with a grand slam home run.
Well, I will tell you that if you were watching that game, that you were probably one of six people who were watching it, because the poor Miami Marlins get no love down here in Florida. We're a couple hundred miles away, and we have the Tampa Bay Rays, which tend to do pretty well. But the Marlins, they can't fill a park for anything.
Well, there was nobody in the stands. I mean, I bet there was more people watching that game in the Northwest than there were definitely anywhere near that park or watching it in Miami.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're excited to have you on the show, Rodney. And, you know, there's a lot of things going on. One of the things I talk consistently about to my clients, and we talk about on the radio show, is to me the two greatest ways to wealth in America. Well, there's really three. But the three fastest way to wealth in America is, number one, you know, start your own business, create something, and become, you know, who knows, you could become Facebook and become a billionaire. But generally speaking, most people, it's either start a small business and grow that business, or they buy real estate, or they invest in the market. And I can't think of any other faster way to gain wealth than those three ways.
Well, and I think you're right, and it's interesting you put it in those terms. That's what capitalism is. It's building on capital. And so the other way to do it is through labor, which is your wages. But it's really hard to gather enough wage, just taking the money in and putting it in a bucket. to become wealthy. So what you have to do is you have to take some of the wage that you earn, and then you have to put it to work, at which point it becomes capital, whether you are starting your own business with it, or you're buying real estate with it, or you're investing in, you know, the markets of some form, you know, the stock market, the bond market,
Oops,
something.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Can you hear?
Yep.
Mine.
We're
Chuck, good.
Are we all still together?
We're still good, Rodney. Chuck must be having issues over there.
My headset came undone there. Well, one of the reasons I brought all that up is that I wanted to ask you about is, as I was going through Harry's book, one of the questions, and a lot of my clients have created a lot of wealth through real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, through investing, we hope, as well. But a lot of them do have a major amount of real estate and invested long-term in real estate. And one of the chapters in Harry's book is that real estate will never be the same.
Well, yes, it won't be the same from the standpoint of real estate enjoyed a dramatic period of growth. And areas are different as to when it happened. But generally from the mid-90s through the mid-2000s, there was this huge run-up that was somewhat akin to what happened in the late 70s. And so if you happen to own large chunks of real estate during that time, then your appreciation was dramatic. And it was certainly enjoyable. It was almost straight up. The question is, what will happen now? We had the big downdraft in 2006 to 2011, and then it's turned around and come back up some, but we're at a plateau. And so that sort of growth that becomes exponential over time, we don't see happening again over the next 15, 20 years, because we just don't have the tailwind of the boomers and those big demographic pushes going on. As a matter of fact, it's the other direction, where boomers are at the point of downsizing and trying to get out of some of their real estate, and young people, frankly, don't have the income to come behind them and buy at the high prices.
You know, Rodney, that's very interesting, because both Chuck and I belong to a little business group, and one of our members is a realtor. And he was telling us that it's really a seller's market right now, that they just don't have the kind of inventory and the buyers that they need. And so he said it's a great time to sell, and that they're able to sell things, you know, fairly well, as long as they're not ridiculously priced, because the people who are buying don't have the wherewithal to, you know, to spend the big bucks. But, you know, the houses that are available to them, a lot of them they don't want. So that's very much your demographic cutting in. The first-time home buyers are fewer and farther between.
They are. And what we've seen over the last several years is what everybody now has noted, which is that investing groups, be it very large funds or be it individuals, have taken a lot of the inventory off the market and turned single-family homes into these rentals, which, you know, it's good. It takes some of the inventory out. But it doesn't lead to a long-term wave of buying, because it's not based on people saying, I want a home for me and my family as we grow and the living situation. It's instead an investment decision saying, well, if I can buy it at this price and rent it out at that price, then I make this residual amount of money. If the price goes up too far, then my metrics don't work anymore. And so that push to buy for investing can go away as quickly as it entered the market.
You know, one of the concerns I have too right now is it is a little bit, being in my age bracket, which is a little older than you, I've seen this happen before. I remember the 80s when we had real estate went nuts for a while, and then all of a sudden that was the first time in my lifetime I remember real estate actually going down, going backwards. And it did that for a couple of years, and then it just like, Of course, the baby boomers were all in effect, and I'm one of them. Then we started buying like crazy again, and the market pushed back up. And I think the concern is there isn't the number of those people being able to do that this time.
Exactly. We don't have that tailwind because the people behind the boomers, the Gen Xers like me, we just don't have big enough numbers. And so while people have made a decent amount in real estate, certainly if they've held it long term, the question is what's in their future. And it could be a period of very modest and even slightly negative growth over the next decade.
Well, you know, Rodney, I have to say at all the meetings, I've heard you described a lot of different ways, but I've never heard you been described as a Gen Xer.
Well, as long as we're putting those generational terms on people, I'm clearly in Gen X, although I'm the older end of it there in the mid-60s.
Well, Rodney, you're making me feel a little better here with these two other guys in the studio. But, you know, about 8 or so years ago, when I was looking to get into a home and the market had run up, I was in a position of, you know, I made a, you know, decent living and average salary. And you looked at what was available for the cost, and it's just like, I'm supposed to spend over half of my income on something that I've got to go and fix up. You know, it's a 20-year-old house that in a kind of a poor neighborhood, and this is what somebody who's making an average or a little better average wage could afford. You knew something's got to change and something's got to give, and you know we had a bit of a reset, obviously with 2008 and all that, but prices are kind of getting back to that scenario again, where the average person can't really go and get something that's decent out there.
Well, and you're absolutely right. And the other part of that is salaries didn't go up. And so if you look at affordability, it's actually less than it was in 2008 based on the median salary in America versus the median price of home. And so this is that yawning difference where, you know, we've been talking about it for some time. Clearly, y'all have been talking about it as we walk through and try to educate people and say, guess what? It's been a good run back up here since the bottom around 2010-11, depending on where you are. But look at the metrics driving it. It doesn't really lend itself to further growth from here. So, you know, if you're in real estate and you're thinking about getting liquid, now's the time. I mean, now is the time to go ahead and make that move.
Yeah, I just know somebody who recently sold their house, and they had three bidders on it, and they ended up getting about $10,000 more than they even started out to sell it for. They had three people bidding on the house and just kept writing it up, and finally got $10,000 more than they had wanted to sell the house for to begin with. So it is kind of a frenzy out there because the limited number of buyers are competing with each other for the better deals.
Yep.
So I think that's going to continue. Something that these guys wouldn't be a privy to, but I attend Harry and your radio, well, it's a webinar every month. And it was kind of interesting to hear the take on what's going on in the world and what events could cause the next market correction. And maybe you might want to talk about that a little bit.
Well, and it's interesting to bring that up because the market is in a correction right now in terms of course, it's been walking down a little bit and kind of being choppy. But if you look at a chart of the major indices, the S&P 500 or Dow, then it looks like a mountain range that's going downhill a little bit. And it has lower highs and then lower lows, which is a classic sign of a correction or a downturn. Question is, how deep will it be and how long will it go? We have what's going on in the Ukraine. That doesn't really affect our equity markets too much. There's a question of energy prices, but I think that's a bit of a smokescreen because the Russians have one big export, which is energy. And so the last thing they want is to ruin their one export. And so everyone says they're going to hold that as some sort of ransom payment. It's like, well, understand it can hurt them a whole lot more than the rest of us, particularly in the U.S. as we grow our own energy in, you know, the central United States. But you still have things out there like China, and China's the big one that really could cause a disruption in the markets. And they keep posting more modest growth numbers. You know, when the Chinese posted GDP growth of 1.4% in the first quarter, that's a big wake-up call. I mean, that turns into about 5.5% on an annual basis when they're used to growing between 8 and 12% a year. And so that's a huge slowdown. And the Chinese put a lot of their money into property. They don't buy into the stock market. They don't buy bonds. They buy apartments. They buy condos and homes. And so the prices are coming down in many of the second, third tier cities. And so investors are losing money and they're getting very angry about it. If they have a retrenchment in capital, a retrenchment in lending for property and buying, and their economy is slowing down, then it could cause, and we think it is causing, a slowdown in the buying of commodities from other countries around the world and a slowdown of buying exports from countries like Germany, who sell a lot of BMWs and Mercedes there. And so that's the real catalyst we see right now that could slow things down. The interesting part is what comes next? You know, if this happens in China, which we think it's in the process of going on, then what is the next step? And unfortunately, it's that same old song that hasn't worked, that same old plan, which is the Central Bank of China, the People's Bank of China, will come in and create a lot of money through extending credit to try and bolster it again to do the same old thing. Well, if you look around the world, the European Central Bank is calling for stimulus right now because they think the euro is too high and they need to get the southern economies going. The Japanese economy stalled, even though they were doing a bunch of stimulus. They just put on a new sales tax. The Chinese economy is slowing down. It's not stalling, but slowing down dramatically. They're looking at more stimulus. And in the U.S., our Fed president, being, you know, Janet Yellen, just came along and said, well, you know, our growth is too slow and too uneven. And so people are thinking, hey, maybe she'll do something too. So once again, the world is looking at central bankers who manipulate currency to say, please bolster the economy again. And we're going to get what we always got. We're going to get a lot more money that's going to create wealth in a few hands. And it's probably not going to lend itself to a lot of economic boom.
Now, do you think she is going to increase the money supply and she's going to print more money?
I don't know. Well, she's doing it right now. I mean, clearly she's not doing it alone, but she is chair over the committee that is doing it to the tune of $55 billion a month, which is just saying it out loud is so bizarre. So the question is the money printing that is going on creating anything in the economy other than very, very low interest rates? I don't think it's doing much good other than that. I believe what they'll do is stay on track of slowing down their rate of spending, but I think they're going to leave interest rates exceptionally low. I mean, 0 to 25 basis points for short-term maturities for years. I don't think they're going to make any moves to raise interest rates, and that is manipulating monetary policy, clearly.
You know, it just amazes me how these intelligent people, supposedly, can be doing this to our economy and looking down the road long term. All they're creating is a lot of problems for our kids and our grandkids.
Well, and it's such a cross purpose. When you look at what we're told to do, being consumers and, you know, average citizens of the country, you know, you pay your taxes and you go to work and you do all the things you do. You're also supposed to plan for your own future. And so there's a push out there right now to discuss retirement planning as the three legs of a retirement stool, which is how it's been talked about for a long time, but it's coming back to the fore because Social Security clearly is in trouble. And so it's Social Security and pensions and private savings. And the commissioner of the IRS was on the radio the other day talking about this exact thing, saying, well, Social Security is not supposed to be everything. It's supposed to be one part of this, one leg of the three-legged stool. And so we're all supposed to be saving for retirement. At which point I raised my hand and said, well, let's review here. I'm supposed to save. Am I supposed to go into the stock market where prices seem exorbitantly high, pushed by some craziness with monetary policy, or am I supposed to go into the bond market where I get no yield because the Fed is manipulating rates lower? And as a matter of fact, I'm probably going to get negative interest rates because inflation is going to eat away what I invest. And so where exactly am I supposed to put my money that I feel comfortable with? And that's the unanswerable question right now.
Yeah, I'm totally amazed at what's going on in this country. And I think people have to understand that you do have to take care of things yourself. But the sad part is when you start really plugging the numbers in for a 25-year-old today who has to put 7.5% of his income into social insecurity, and his employer has to match that at 7.5%. So that's 15%. And Kevin, how many of our clients are putting 15% in their 401k? Very few. I mean, I would be willing to bet you that if they ran numbers on young people, particularly anybody under the age of 50, they probably are putting more into Social Security than they are into their 401ks. And they have to. They have no choice. They have to do it because it's a payroll deduction.
Yep, that's required.
And that's the sad part about this whole thing, because we're really ripping off we're ripping off the middle generation to pay for the next generation because we had to pay for the first generation. It's kind of crazy.
Well, Rodney, if I were a Machiavellian, one of those hands of the few that get the money, And mm-hmm. I said to myself, well, gee whiz, if we want to build some real capital here for us good guys, us few handfuls, and I was also plugged into the intelligence community and all of that stuff, and we could somehow get the arms race started between the Soviet Union and the United States again, wouldn't that present some pretty unique opportunities for investors and also maybe be halfway good for the economy by, you know, building, you know, missile systems that might not work and, you know, all that kind of stuff?
Well, there's no question that it would be good for a certain segment of the economy. If I'm a defense contractor, and you have a couple of those up there in the Northwest, certainly you could use up some raw materials and build some things and put some people to work. But the money to do all that has to come from somewhere. And typically an arms race is fueled by taxes on citizens or borrowing by the country, which is how we did it in the past. I'm not so sure that eventually that works out. I think that goes all the way back to Chuck's point of eventually we're just burdening our children and our grandchildren, and at the end of the day we look around and go, wow, that's a lot of boats to decommission down the road because hopefully we'd never use them. It would just be an arms race with, you know, no eventual use.
We know we have opened up the lines here. If somebody wants to call and ask Rodney a question, you can call 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. And toll-free for everybody in the outlying areas, you can call 800-990-0750. That's 1-800-990-0750. And anybody calls and asks a question, I will give them a free copy of Harry Dent's new book titled The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019. And in talking about deflation, I've suddenly, there's been kind of a little change, and I'm sure you guys notice it too, but I notice on the business networks, because I watch them all the time, because I'm talking to my clients about investing their money, mm-hmm. and I notice there's a little more discussion of demographics, there's a little more discussion about deflation, and you never heard that much before Harry Dent started talking about it.
Yeah, it's my wife hates reading the paper with me because I point at things and say, we wrote this, you know, we talked about this 2 years ago, we talked about this, and this morning I'm reading through Barron's, and sure enough, I get to a story with Arnott, who's a famous hedge fund manager, and the story is about him pointing to demographics as the reason that he likes emerging markets. And it's like, well, clearly that makes sense. And we've been talking about this for so long that the next step in investing, not today, but several years from now, is to emerging markets where the demographics are younger, the spending is going to be more in line with what the baby boomers did years ago. And so clearly that's the push. And what that leaves in the older developed nations, like certainly like the nations of Europe and the U.S. some right now, more than it will be in the future, is deflation, as you have people trying to pay down debt and save more instead of pushing spending. And you're right, this was something that no one talked about ever. And as recently as a year ago, if you go back to stories about Europe with the European Central Bank and the Southern European economies versus Germany and France in the north, nobody talked about deflation. And we kept telling people, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. And now here they are with the European Central Bank talking about the different paths that they might take to monetary stimulus because they're worried about deflation. It's like, of course you are. It's the natural course of your economy right now.
Yeah, I can remember about 6 months ago we talked on our show, and I can't remember if it was talking with you or with Harry about it, but we talked about the fact that finally Charles Schwab has finally said that you got to consider demographics in your investing strategy. I thought that was pretty amazing. Finally, he's talking about it after all this time.
After all this time, and it's more interesting because you'll hear so many people talk about it as if it's something that they've considered and discussed for years. They say, well, of course you do. It's like, wait, you were the people dismissing this for the last 5, 10, 20 years, and now you finally come around to recognizing this. The least you could do is give a little credit, but that's okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've enjoyed watching that video with Harry and Ron and Santa. Because
mm-hmm.
I don't think he still understands demographics.
But he will. I mean, other people have come around. Ron and Santa can come around, too. That'll be okay.
Yeah, I'm sure he will.
Well, from the tax perspective, I know you guys have mentioned before too that, you know, with this huge amount of baby boomers that were making all of this money retiring, you know, the tax revenues coming in for the government, is not what they're projecting as this, you know, huge population growth that they continue on with this, curved projection of population growth and that taxes are going to be along those same lines. Well, that's not the case. So the people that are working are, there's going to be fewer and we're going to have to be paying more taxes. And, you know, with Obamacare and the changes that they have put in, talking with other tax professionals after the season here, we've been really surprised at how much taxes have gone up for people that are working.
Oh, and particularly people who are in a higher tax bracket.
Exactly.
And you're looking at not only did your, the specific bracket go up, but then you're paying the additional tax on investment income that's part of the Affordable Care Act, and a lot of local taxes have gone up, but it won't be enough. And part of this conversation is not just that fewer people are going to be working, which is clearly the case. It's going on right now as we see the participation rate in labor fall. But also economic growth won't be as strong as the government projects. And if you look at the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, that does these projections for Congress, and say, well, we'll be around 2.5% or so, and then we're going to go 3-4% for the indefinite future. And their reasoning behind it is because we can't stay at this low level. And there's no explanation beyond it. Just, well, staying low would be unreasonable. Therefore, we expect it to be higher. It's like, well, the world's been unreasonable before. So if we get low economic growth for a longer period, another 5 to 7 years, which we think is going to be the case, then it's going to severely affect how much in tax the government takes in. But they still have to pay all their bills. So that's where the fight starts.
You know, I don't understand how in this country we could have people just stand up like the President of the United States stands up and gives a number. 1 week it's 7 million, now it's 8 million. And he gives unsubstantiated numbers that he just throws out there. And then when they're questioned, even by Congress, they can't give definite numbers. But yet he can come out and say, with his people who are under oath, who are running the program, can't give any numbers. But then he comes around to a news conference a week later and says, we have 8 million people signed up.
Yeah, but nobody knows how many are paid. And nobody knows how many previously had insurance. And now the census has changed how they're measuring the number of people who claim to have insurance. So we'll never have a clear idea. I chalk it all up to politics. Clearly, a lot of people have signed up. Clearly, it's less than 8 million have paid for their premiums. We know that to be true. Clearly, a lot of them were people who previously had insurance but lost it because their plan changed because of the Affordable Care Act. So we know that. We just don't know how the pieces are arranged on the chessboard.
But how do you – well, of course, the government isn't a business. That's the problem. They don't have to be accountable. You know, have you ever read anything by Malcolm Burko?
Malcolm Burko. I don't know
okay,
that I have.
Malcolm Burko is a self-made millionaire out of Chicago, out of Illinois. And he's a writer, and he's written a lot of things about the federal government and social insecurity and stuff. And he actually wrote a letter to the Social Security Department and asked them for a full accounting of all the money they've taken in and all the money they've spent out. And they don't have the numbers. he wrote in one of his articles that in his estimation we've blown through $20 trillion they cannot account for.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, that's happens to exceed the national debt right now.
Oh yeah, by about $3 trillion.
Yeah, yeah. But I thought it was very interesting. I didn't know if you'd read him or not, but he has a column that appears in our paper a couple times a week, and I read him every week because he's a good common sense investor. He talks about stock investments and stuff because he is a self-made millionaire in the stock market.
Oh,
and a great writer. He's in his 70s. The thing I like about him is, he did come to the conclusion when he hit 70 years old, he said, I can no longer handle my money for myself, and I went to a fee-based financial planner to help me manage my money because I realized there's a day coming, and if something happens to me, my wife hasn't got a clue about the market.
Right, right. And that's an interesting point for me, as I look around at what people do, particularly, of course, the baby boomers, very large generation, who are driven to learn more, to educate themselves, and to do things on their own. But at some point, and I think it's happening, I think the rotation is occurring, the front end of the baby boomers are looking up and going, you know, it's not just me, it's my family. And things are going on, and I think one of the big drivers of this change in their point of view is having to deal with it with their parents and watching one parent pass and first being sick or ill in some way, and you don't want to think about the finances. You've got to deal with the health issues that are going on, and then that parent passes, and the other parent has to kind of pick up the pieces, and it's very difficult if things are in a filing cabinet here and a drawer over there and behind this password online over here, and maybe you don't know the correct password. So much simpler if you're dealing with somebody who has taken kind of all the pressure out of that. They've got all of it available for you. They know the forms you have to file to make transfers and transitions, and they can keep it all the balls in the air while you're going through life and dealing with some things that are very important.
You've described one of my favorite themes in estate planning, Rodney, that is to be somewhat organized so that when somebody else has to take over your stuff, they can find where it is and do something with it. And dealing with our parents' generation, it's so often the case that they are organized in a sense, but they're usually in packets of envelopes wrapped in rubber bands. There are millions of people out there who have that same experience. They go and there are no files. There are boxes with stacks of envelopes that are, you know, neatly rubber banded together.
Or cottage cheese cartons.
Yeah.
It's a real simple thing. And I like asking people questions when I give presentations. And when it comes to this, I'll ask people, how many of you, as a spouse, know how to find the login for your investment account? And the numbers are kind of small. And so, okay, how many of you as spouses know who to call when there's a question on your IRA or your 401k or pension? And then the numbers get really small. It's like you're going to be digging through envelopes. You're going to be digging through some old papers and files trying to find this stuff, and there's no reason to. So when you could have this conversation now and create some of this, you know, shared information so that everyone knows where to find it when the day comes, and yet people don't.
You know, you hit another theme number two on estate planning, because one of the big problems is with what they call, you know, intellectual or technological property. And like you said, passwords and things like that. There are many instances where the spouse who doesn't know it, or you know, someone else, maybe a trustee or the personal representative, doesn't know it, and they need it. May be the only way they can find anything, and they can't get it because all of that stuff is very difficult to get to. Even if you're appointed by the court, you know, can you imagine trying to get through the Google gatekeepers to say, you know, give me the passwords for this dead person? I mean, it's possible, but it might take you forever.
1-800-CALL-GOOGLE doesn't work very well.
Exactly, you know, and it's like, you know, it's like trying to change the mind of the credit bureaus. That ain't going to happen, so it's just really hard.
Well, you know, we really appreciate your time, Rodney, and this half hour has flown by. And I got to say, I think this show came to the top, one of our best shows ever. So we really appreciate it, and I know you guys are getting set up to do your tour here in May. And I still tell my clients all the time, I think we have a lot of people in the Northwest that have signed up for your Survive and Prosper free newsletter. And I tell them they can go on harrydent.com, or they can go on my website. I have a link to that so they can sign up. And I know there's a lot of Northwesterners now subscribing to that free newsletter.
Well, we appreciate that. I like having the outreach up there.
And listen, we appreciate your time, and we look forward to talking to you again in about 2 months, and we'll talk to Harry next month.
Sounds great, Chuck. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Rodney. Appreciate your time. You're listening to Investing Simplified. If you've got a question for Carl, Kevin, or Chuck, you can call us at 503-417-7626, or toll-free 800-990-0750. We'll take a quick break and come back with Carl's comments.
Financial Group Wealth Management.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson, and this is the time for Carl's comments. And this time I thought we'd talk about a question that was given to us by a listener. And it says, Carl, we live in Oregon and have $2 million in property and investments in Oregon in a living trust, but have property in Washington that is also worth $2 million. Does the property in Washington affect Oregon estate taxes? And so before I give my answer, last week I kind of gave a general dodge around the question sort of answer, and I'm probably going to do a little bit of that today because it is much more complicated than you might expect. And fortunately, this week we have our tax expert in our field here. So he is going to, you know, hold the sword of truth and justice over my head. As we discuss,
is that like holding your feet to the fire?
Feet to the fire. Yeah, however this all works. So basically, there are some complicated sorts of things that go into this, and the devil is in the definitions. And so I give you this as a disclaimer that this is just an estimate and a rough knowledge of how this might work. And Kevin is going to either laugh at me or not. But let me give you, first of all, the thought that I'm going to make some assumptions to make it easier, because in looking at both of the estate tax laws in Oregon and Washington, they are somewhat different, not only in terms of the exemption amounts, but in the way that they apply them. So I thought what we'd at least do is try to take a look at it from the standpoint of someone who lives in Oregon. That's the first assumption. And in this instance, I'm going to ascribe to these people a situation where, well, they do say that they have their investment properties are in a living trust, but I'm going to assume that that living trust was done a long, 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 long time ago and did not provide for any kind of tax planning, because then we're going to have all sorts of different numbers. But this is just as though the surviving, or there's a spouse and the spouse has died and they now have this $4 million estate, $2 million in Washington in real property, and $2 million here in Oregon. And so we're going to use that as kind of the base point, because otherwise things kind of lose any kind of accuracy very quickly. So first of all, we're going to look at, you know, and basically we're only going to look at the Oregon taxable estate, and which essentially the Oregon starts with pretty much what the federal government calls the gross estate. So we start with that, and then we apply, Oregon has a table of taxes and percentages that they apply to this. So you take the $4,000, $4 million, you include, and it includes the property in Washington. So you take the $4 million estate and you apply the tax table and you come up with $257,500. Then you have to, as tax, then you have to add 11% of the $500,000 over this particular table. And that ends up being 11% of $500,000. So you end up with a total tax amount that's calculated of $312,500. Now then, so you've included the property that is in Washington. So then you take a look at it and you have to apply a formula, a ratio to this particular property to come up with the ultimate tax. And this is where it gets really, really interesting. So the numerator of that fraction is essentially it ends up being all of the property, including any intangible property. So your numerator, the top number, ends up being $4 million. And the bottom number is, guess what? The gross state. So the denominator ends up being $4 million. So the ratio is 1. So you multiply 1 times the tax, and you end up with $312,500. So, yes, it does affect. Now then, it might be different if you started with Washington. And there are many, many variables. So I'm not even going to try to go into all of that. But as a practical matter, they're going to try to get you wherever. Now, my view of it is that it probably wouldn't make a difference in Washington, because the property in Washington came in under, for non-residents, they only look at the taxable estate, tangible assets, personal property, and real estate in the state of Oregon or Washington. And so there you have the $2 million exemption. So you probably escape the tax there, because it comes under the exemption, so they never get to the formula part. So that's my thought on it. Anybody who's a wizard on both of those tax things that disagrees, I'd be glad to listen. But that's generally the idea I would have in mind. So, bring down the sword of justice there, Mr. Tax Guy.
Nothing to swing here. That was pretty good. And, in general, if you're an Oregon resident, your domicile is a huge thing. Where the person was living when they passed away, even when you have a trustee of a trust, say somebody passed in Oregon, but the trustee's in Washington. Well, intangible assets such as stocks and things like that, those things are taxed where the trustee is domiciled, not where the decedent died. Mm. So you really have to look at, know your jurisdictions. And like you were saying, I mean, basically Oregon is going to tax an Oregon resident on their worldwide, if you will, assets, and potentially give you a tax break if you pay tax on an asset that's in another state. And in this scenario, they didn't have to pay any tax to Washington for their $2 million that was in Washington. So Oregon.
So they didn't get a break in Oregon.
Isn't going to give you a break, yeah. And they're going to tax you on everything, yeah, on your Oregon property and your Washington property, because you were an Oregon resident when you died. Yeah. So that's take the flip situation. Say they were a Washington resident. They had $2 million in Washington, $2 million in Oregon. How is Oregon going to tax that? You've got...
Same kind of a situation. They're going to look at the non-resident, the non-resident property for a resident. They start essentially with the gross estate as well. They start with Washington real property, Washington tangible personal property, and all intangible property. And they say that a resident's intangible property is anywhere.
Yep.
So they kind of start in the same place.
Exactly. Your Oregon return's basically gonna, if you're a non-resident of Oregon and you have some real estate and you have to file a return, you're gonna show $4 million on your Oregon return, but then you'd put a percentage of your Oregon property that's taxable as a percentage to the gross estate as a whole, and that's gonna prorate your tax.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah, and even if it's under $1 million, say you have $3 million in Washington and $500,000 in Oregon. Oregon is going to tax that $500,000.
Yeah, but then they're going to be under the $1 million exemption, so they're probably going to be okay.
No, they will still tax it.
Oh no, wait. If you're a resident,
no.
Yeah, if you're an Oregon resident, you mean?
No. If you're a Washington non-resident, you have $3 million, and you have $500,000 in Oregon. You have a taxable estate over $1 million. You have,
but you're a resident in Oregon, right?
No, Washington.
Oh, I thought you said non-resident Washington.
No, a non-resident of Oregon.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And so, if you have an asset in Oregon that's a taxable asset, even if it's under $1 million, if your gross estate is over $1 million, then you have.
And they have you're going to get
Oregon's going to get their pound of flesh.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Wow.
Depending on how much it is and what kind of property.
Exactly right. Yeah. Exactly. There's so many what ifs in this.
So I know that probably confuses just about everybody, including me. But I think really the only way that you can ever ultimately decide with any kind of degree of precision is to be able to take a snapshot of what exists at the time of the death, and then run it through the two 706 type forms, the estate tax forms in both states, and come up with answers. And hopefully I think sometimes there have been some problems, and over the years there have been court cases that talk about the definitions of intangible property and the definition of a non-resident, and there, you know, and so it's taken some time, and hopefully the tax forms have kept up with the law, but they seem to have, but I don't know the answer to that entirely. But there are some calculations that get made, and I think suffice it to say that all of the states like to. To the extent that they can, they want to tax, you know, property that relates to their state.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back with the tax investigator.
And we will continue this conversation in a different manner.
Okay, we'll be right back.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over 3 decades, and its 9 attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
All right, welcome back to Investing Simplified, and we'll get continue that train of thought, and we'll just get right into it. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about community property and common law states. Community property states and common law states, and basically there's some real tax saving opportunities that you have to address, and this isn't just when somebody passes away. This is you need to address this as part of your estate plan. And in general, the benefit to, first off, there's 10 community property law states. Oregon is surrounded by them. Oregon, Idaho, Nevada, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and a couple others.
Washington.
Yeah, Washington.
Washington.
Yeah.
I forgot that
Oregon
one.
Oregon is the only one in the middle that isn't.
Yeah, Oregon's property. The common law state.
Exactly. And the benefit to community property is when the first spouse dies, everything's considered
each owns a half, essentially, an undivided half.
That's the legalese. That's right. Thank you very
undivided,
much.
Undivided, yes.
Thank you. And so when the first spouse dies, the other spouse actually gets a step up in basis on their half of the property also. And that's really the key tax planning opportunity here. And so, we all know the step up in basis is a huge opportunity to get out of income tax. It really, this isn't an estate tax issue. This is an income tax issue with the beneficiaries. And so when the first spouse dies, both the whole community of assets for this marital community gets a step up, which is huge.
Yes. Otherwise, the half that the
survivor
spouse had in the separate property stays at the same basis.
Exactly.
Basically, they get half the step up instead of the whole step up, basically.
Exactly. And so one of the planning opportunities here is what happens if you move from a community property state to a common law state. So say you move from California to Oregon. That's a pretty common scenario and happens quite often. How is that property treated? Is it now Oregon property and you don't get the step up in basis? Or is it community property? And there's been a lot of cases and a lot of law arguments over this. And fortunately, if you do things right and you plan it correctly, you can keep community property as community property. And we'll step away from that just for a second because we've got a caller.
Will, you got a question about a will? It's Rich, and you have a question about a will?
Yes. If a beneficiary is on public assistance and the owner of the plan anyway dies, is there any percentage or whatever that the state can come and claim part of that?
You mean if the person who dies was on public assistance? Is that what you mean?
The beneficiary.
Oh, the beneficiary, the person who gets the estate.
Yes.
And then the question is, but not the person who died. The person who died didn't owe any money or anything, and they weren't on public assistance, and they're giving an inheritance to the beneficiary.
Yes.
Who is on?
The answer depends in part on what the public assistance is. There are some kinds of public assistance which are what they call needs-based, such things as SSI and such things as Medicaid. And those kinds of things are—and when they're needs-based, and they are those kinds of assets, then if you—because you're supposed to—in order to qualify for those assets, you have to have— or qualify for those benefits, you have to generally have spent down your assets to no more than $2,000, at least here in Oregon. So that means if you get more than $2,000, you get disqualified for those benefits that are based on that. And that's why if you're going to give an inheritance to someone who has those kind of benefits, you can do what's called a supplemental needs trust. Sometimes they call it a special needs trust, which then acts as a supplement to the benefits that the person's getting. In other words, they can pay for things that are other than the things that are intended to be paid for by the benefit from the government. But they can't just take the money and do anything they want with it. It's held by a trustee, and they have to be very careful about how they administer that. So does that kind of answer your question?
Does this go into probate? That's when it happens.
A will would generally go into probate, and then it would and then the personal representative would transfer that. But if the person who's getting it, you know, that what should happen at that point if it looks like by giving that inheritance to the person that's getting the benefits and they know that it's going to disqualify them, then they can go through the personal representative, and the personal representative can establish a supplemental needs trust so that they can give it to them without disqualifying their benefits. But there, it's a fairly, you know, you have to go through some kind of complex stuff to do that.
But the state or whoever, they can't put a lien on the amount of money that they're getting?
No, they really don't. They don't. If they might be able to get, well, that depends on if it's from a third party, no, they won't.
But okay.
If it was, you know, so now like in families sometimes what happens, say for example, husband and wife here in Oregon, if one spouse goes into, say, assisted care and they have to go on Medicaid so that they can pay for that care, they have to have facility care. And then if there's much left at the end of the day after the, say, for example, the spouse then later dies, the spouse in the institution dies, and then they don't usually do anything. But then if the spouse who remained in the family home later dies, then the state can come back to look at the assets of the surviving spouse who just died and can come after those assets to the extent that they provided benefits to the spouse. So, and they do. There's a unit in Oregon called the Estate Recovery Unit who are quite diligent about trying to find, you know, people where a source of funds to reimburse them for money that they have paid out to folks. So, you know, it's hard to, there used to be a number of ways to sort of circumvent some of that. And there are still some techniques to do that, but they're not as attractive as they once were. And so a lot of people don't do it. There are a number of people who kind of specialize in those kinds of areas. They sometimes call it elder law, I guess you might say, but it's essentially Medicaid planning. But a lot of the tools of the Medicaid planner have been sort of erased over the years, and it's not nearly as easy to avoid the state coming back and getting their piece of the action.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for your program.
You bet. It's a pleasure. Program. Thank you for calling.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Thank you very much. It was a good call, Rich. Kevin, as you were saying.
Yeah, you know, with our, we only have about 5 minutes left, and this is actually a topic I wanted to spend a little time on. So what I'm going to do is just briefly wrap it up, and I know we'll you've got a few items to share here before we get off the air. So
no, you go right ahead.
No. So, but, you know, regarding the community property and separate property, a lot of tax planning opportunities, especially if you're moving into a state or moving out of a state of a different law that's in effect. And even some of the separate property states, there's a group of them that have agreed to a certain set of rules, and there's another group of them that have a different set of rules, in fact, very broad rules that say, some of them even say, well, you can elect your property to be treated as any other state's jurisdiction.
Yeah, actually, Oregon, there is a law here in Oregon called the Uniform Community Property Act, I believe, that close to that. And it basically does that. It allows a person who moves into the state who brings community property with them to allow them to preserve that as community property.
Mm-hmm. And that needs to be done. If there's certain bookkeeping and accounting that you have to follow too with that, because you have to keep those assets separate to make sure that you show that, hey, this was the community property that was brought in. These are the earnings and the income that it's made over X number of years since I came in. Mm-hmm. And to be able to get the step up on that, it is huge for income tax purposes. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to find out, to investigate here, if you move from Oregon to Washington, can you sign a CPA, not a certified public accountant, but a community property agreement, and convert your Oregon assets into community property?
Well, that's a question we'll answer next week.
Yeah, that's a little tune. Kevin, how does somebody get a hold of you?
We are at 503-666-5569, and you can find us on the World Wide Web at BakerColson.com.
And Carl?
Warren Allen is at 503-255-8795 and on warrenallen.com.
And you can catch me on pfgwm.com. Check out the website. We've got a lot of good information there. And if you have not reviewed your portfolio and need a financial checkup, give me a call, 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week with Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group, Wealth Management. Price Financial Group, Wealth Management.